Yeah, that's basically it. I'll just introduce Vashti. Vashti Kenway is a lead member of Socialist Alternative, been involved in anti-fascist, anti-racist activists in Melbourne. She's a regular contributor to the Marxist Left Review, has written on the history of Islamophobia in Australia, the history of concentration camps in Australia as well. People should definitely get a subscription to the Marxist Left Review at the moment at the conference. If you buy a subscription, you get a free back issue as well. So I really recommend everyone making the most of that. Vashi's going to speak for a bit. There'll be discussion after that. We'll sort of take it from there. So please, everyone, make Vashti feel very welcome.
January in 2017, just a few days after Donald Trump was inaugurated, Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism sold out on Amazon. The dramatic and unexpected victory of Donald Trump, I suppose, prompted a kind of cavalcade of commentators and writers and journalists and authors to seek out a variety of different kind of explanations, both theoretical and historical, for how someone like Donald Trump could get elected. And into this kind of pantheon of writers came Hannah Arendt. Writer after writer declared her analysis of totalitarianism absolutely vital for comprehending the election. And in particular, they used her in a way to discuss the base of Donald Trump's support. How could Donald Trump get elected in the 21st century? One Guardian article by a journalist called Zoe Williams is particularly emblematic. She argued that the reason, I suppose, that Donald Trump got elected was because of the dynamics of a mass base. And she said, "The term masses applies only where we deal with people who, either because of sheer numbers or indifference, or a combination of both, cannot be integrated into any organisation based on common interest." And this is where she also kind of quotes Arendt here. She says these masses cannot be brought into political parties or municipal governments or professional organisations or trade unions. Potentially, they exist in every country and form the majority of those large numbers of neutral, politically indifferent people who will never join a party and hardly ever go to the polls. Now, regardless of whether you think these are actually the questions, the right questions to be asking about Donald Trump's election, and in lots of ways, I think, just beginning with a particular kind of sector of the people who voted for Donald Trump and trying to analyse them and understand them doesn't engage with the full kind of reality of what brought Donald Trump to power, they're nonetheless, I think, really important issues to engage in and one that have very serious consequences for your analysis of politics today. So the concept of a mass that is drawn to totalitarian ideas is probably one of the most utilised of Hannah Arendt's arguments. And for this reason, and the fact that it's a key part of her work in The Origins of Totalitarianism, I really want to spend a chunk of time today talking about that particular analysis. The fact that this is an element of her work shouldn't blind us to the fact that she is hugely kind of wide-ranging, and if people have read, like, how many people in the room have read The Origins of Totalitarianism? From start to finish? Okay, very small number, but I actually want to it's an extremely wide-ranging book. It has it's quite eclectic in a way. It has a series of different chapters that deal, for instance, with the role of imperialism in the dynamics of the system, the question of anti-Semitism. There's quite a long and really fascinating sort of analysis of that. But mainly today I just want to deal with the kind of chapters that talk about totalitarianism as kind of a theory and so on. So if you do want to go back and look at it after this session, you can obviously start from start to end, but if you just you could just kind of launch in there, it'll be fine. The whole kind of issue of the kind of context of Arendt's writing is something I think it's worth just dealing with briefly. Arendt herself was born in 1906 to a German Jewish family, and after finishing high school she enrolled at Marburg University, where she studied philosophy with Martin Heidegger, who she had quite a tumultuous both personal and political and philosophical relationship. After the kind of rise of Nazism, she broke with him. As people may or may not know, he ended up joining the Nazi Party, and she left the province. She began organising with Zionist groups in Berlin in 1933, and she was arrested and interrogated for 8 days because she was doing research in the Prussian State Library on anti-Semitic Nazi propaganda. She then fled from Germany and eventually made her way to Paris. And in 1940, like many other German Jewish illegal emigres, she was sent to an internment camp called Gurs as an alien enemy. Now, it was kind of in the chaos of the first few days when the Nazis had invaded France that she managed to escape from there, and she rejoined her husband, Heinrich Blücher, and eventually they managed to kind of surreptitiously manage to cross the Spanish border and make their way to Lisbon, where they sailed for New York. And for 18 years, she lived in New York as a stateless person, and she finally became an American citizen, you know, just after that period. But nonetheless, she talked a lot, and people have kind of encountered Hannah Arendt in other contexts at university or, you know, to the extent that she's kind of discussed her work on being stateless and the question of the kind of category of statelessness in a world that is completely bound up in a system of kind of nationalism and national borders is actually really powerful and, you know, raises some kind of important questions regarding refugee rights and the kind of questions of, you know, rights altogether. So there's kind of big debate around all of that, but I'm not going to be dealing so much with the kind of, you know, broader theoretical or philosophical questions about rights today because that would be kind of a lot to go through. But, yeah, so she kind of talks, I suppose, about the reality of statelessness as one of the most dehumanising categories that exists in modernity. She says, "Not the loss of specific rights, then, but the loss of community of a community willing and able to guarantee any rights whatsoever has been the calamity which has befallen ever-increasing numbers of people. Man, it turns out, can lose all the so-called rights of man without losing his essential quality as a man, his human dignity. Only the loss of a polity expels him from humanity." And this kind of also relates to her more general conception of what it means to be human means to be part of a polity, which kind of is a political kind of world. And again, we can kind of get to some of those ideas a little bit further down the track. So she settled in New York and lived there for the rest of her life. She became an editor and a writer and worked for the Jewish Cultural Reconstruction. And she became an American citizen, as I said before, in 1950. And this was probably the most productive period of her life in terms of her written work. She published The Origins in 1951. And when you think, 1951, the war's only been over for a few years. And this is a highly substantial theoretical kind of work on the underpinnings of Nazism, the war, you know, the drive to it, what caused it, what created it. And it was made a huge splash at the time. Almost nothing else had been written of its calibre that was discussing the kind of the relationship between anti-Semitism, attempting to kind of grapple and come up with a theory for, you know, for fascism and the Soviet regimes. So it was a real breakthrough work at the time. In 1958, she published The Human Condition and the book On Revolution in 1963. But probably most people here would know her as someone who, you know, wrote the very famous work Eichmann in Jerusalem, which, a few more nods. Have people seen the film that came out about her? She coined the phrase, the banality of evil. Or not. All right. Okay, that's good. And that, I suppose, in that, Eichmann was a, you know, fairly low-level Nazi who had overseen some of the concentration camps and was put on trial. And she wrote a piece kind of about the, when she talks about the banality of evil, I suppose it's kind of referring to the kind of fairly prosaic and highly kind of bureaucratized way in which the Holocaust was carried out. And that, you know, it wasn't just some kind of exceptional horror, it was a reflection of, and again this kind of relates to her broader argument, of the, I suppose, increasing bureaucratization of society and as a kind of the upshot of Enlightenment thinking. But again, But, you know, to make that sort of argument was not well received. You know, in lots of circles, and especially some of the more hardline Zionist circles who didn't want analysis of the war, weren't interested at all in there being, I suppose, an argument about the connections between the kinds of societies that, you know, existed across the world and the Holocaust, and much more wanted an argument that detailed the kind of exceptionalism of the Holocaust and, you know, the evil of the situation, rather than, you know, actually dealing with a more substantive argument. So Arendt refused easy categorisation. She was always insisting that she was not a philosopher, and she was not also merely a political writer. She also rejected a simple Heideggerian tag. She drew on ancient Greek philosophy and had a sometimes sympathetic relationship, sometimes a confrontational relationship with Marx and with the left more generally. And she died in 1975. Okay, so to move on to the substance of her writings about totalitarianism. So Arendt argued that totalitarianism was unprecedented, that it was something entirely new, which is not to be assimilated with or confused with the categories of tyranny or dictatorship. She argues that totalitarian societies emerged at a particular historical and political juncture. They weren't destined to do so, but a whole kind of confluence of historical elements meant that they did. She said, "What is unprecedented in totalitarianism is not primarily its ideological content, but the event of totalitarian domination itself." So the event of totalitarianism explodes our categories of political thought and our standards of moral judgment. So she says, "Everything we know of totalitarianism demonstrates a horrible originality. Its very actions constitute a break with all our traditions." So she makes some distinction between totalitarian movements in which the impulses towards totalitarian societies are there, but not fully realised. So she says there's kind of movements, and then there's totalitarian societies. So there's totalitarian impulses, there's totalitarian movements, and then there's the totalitarian societies themselves. But she argues that nonetheless there are two archetypal, both totalitarian movements and totalitarian societies in the 20th centuries, and that these were Bolshevism in terms of the movement, and then in terms of the state, the Stalinist states, and then she says there's the fat Nazi movement, and then there's the state under Hitler. And she characterises all of, you know, those kind of four moments as being emblematic in the history of totalitarianism. She places much less emphasis on the content of the different totalitarian movements than their methods for gaining support. So she argues that party platforms that are almost completely irrelevant for totalitarianism itself. And the key here is loyalty. So she, to kind of flesh out this point, she argues that party platforms shift and change, but the important element is the movement participants subject themselves to the will of the party or the state. And here she uses the examples of the kind of various twists and turns of the communist parties. After Stalin came to power, people might know that there were kind of very sharp zigzags of policy with regards to how you organise, what attitudes you bear to particular states. So, for instance, from the kind of United Front to the Popular Front and so on, you know, and that there was a tendency for supporters of the Communist Party or members of the Communist Party to just kind of go along with this, and that is an argument that actually the content doesn't matter at all, and what matters is kind of blind commitment to the party itself, so loyalty. She argues that, she argues that methods of totalitarian propaganda, in her words, present disagreements as invariably originating in deep, natural, social or psychological sources beyond the control of the individual and therefore beyond the power of reason. So she argues reason cannot fathom anti-Semitism. Another element of this non-reason is violence, which she argues is a key part of totalitarian movements and societies. Totalitarian movements are attracted to a particular kind of terrorist violence because those attracted by totalitarianism are expressing a deep bitterness at their exile from the previously dominant elements of society. So she has quite an interesting discussion where she says the following. It was no longer a matter of calculated policy, which saw in terrorist acts the only means to eliminate certain outstanding personalities who, because of their policies or position, had become the symbols of oppression. So if you kind of think of the Narodniks in Russia who, you know, obviously, you know, chose particular figureheads as the objects of their terrorist violence, you know, to go and find the child of, you know, some wealthy figure or whatever to kind of assassinate her in the 60s and 70s, kind of similar dynamics. She says that the kind of terrorism of totalitarianism is kind of different from that. She says, what proved so attractive was that terrorism had become a kind of philosophy through which to express frustration, resentment, and blind hatred, a kind of political expressionism which uses bombs to express oneself, which watched delightedly the publicity given to resounding deeds and was absolutely willing to pay the prices of life for having succeeded in forcing the recognition of one's existence on the normal strata of society. So it's kind of, you know, I'm not sure I'd agree with the kind of entire analysis of it, but it's an interesting way of thinking about political violence for particular kind of political movements. The violence of totalitarian societies, as opposed to movements, is a violence associated with total domination. These societies break up any social ties, they break up families, they break up friendships, and so on, but not simply through repression. So the Stalinist purges played the role of undermining all relationships. You never know who is a spy, Arendt argues, who is watching you, and all of this has the effect of turning the public realm of the political into the private realm of families and intimate relationships. And so that dynamic kind of has the effect, much like the Panopticon, of creating an internal psychological surveillance. So the individual begins to surveil themselves. So the kind of violence of the totalitarian regime is not then just external in the world of the kind of public polity. It becomes, you know, an intimate part of how individuals are kind of governed in these societies. Furthermore, the totalitarian societies and the institutions destroy what Arendt understands as what makes human human. And this happens in a few ways, but primarily by transforming the individual into a thing. All human action becomes utilitarian. So she argues that Himmler really summed up this transformation when he defined SS members as the new type of man who under no circumstances will ever do a thing for its own sake. So for her, the concentration camps were the end point of this trajectory. She argues that they're meant to not only exterminate people and to degrade human beings, but they also serve the ghastly experiment of eliminating, under scientifically controlled conditions, spontaneity itself as an expression of human behaviour and of transforming the human personality into a mere thing, into something that even animals are not. And here she quotes, "For Pavlov's dog, which we know was trained to eat not when it was hungry, but when a bell rang, and this was a perverted animal." So she kind of says that under totalitarian societies, the essence of what it means to be human is completely degraded and removed, and that actions don't become part of an expression of humanity, but a result of a kind of an external, prompt. And so she says, in the camps, there is a systematic attempt to annihilate individuality, plurality, natality, spontaneity, and freedom, and to create living corpses. So before I kind of get to a little bit more and some of my critique, I just want to say briefly what her critique of Marx is. Because Arendt maintains that there is a strain in Marx, although this isn't entirely what she thinks of Marx, but that leads straight to the totalitarian regimes. So she argues that because Marx emphasises labour as one of the key processes that makes us human, he sidelines the political and the social. I suppose I would respond to that by saying it's a complete misreading of Marx, And is in fact a reflection of Arendt's own dualism, which sees labour as physical and the political as intellectual and social. And I don't think there's any... you're able to sustain that kind of critique of Marx. For Marx, labouring upon the world is simultaneously physical and intellectual, and it's creative and social. So labour's not just work, in the sense that we might understand it under capitalism. It's not just the act of doing a task physically. It's much more than that, and it's the act of working upon and within the world to shape it. But Arendt sort of can't seem to understand that, and she implies that there's more of a relationship between Marx's emphasis on labour, the development of kind of capitalism as a society which prioritises and emphasises labour, you know, as sort of similar phenomena. And, you know, she kind of even goes so far as saying it's no surprise that in the society, that Arbeit macht frei is the kind of the sign above Auschwitz, there's some link there between Marx's emphasis on labour and the Nazis' emphasis on labour. So in terms of the mass base of totalitarianism, Arendt argues that modern society is dominated by the economic, in which the plurality of individuals is destroyed. The emphasis on the human as worker rather than as political individuals has over time transformed society. And that trend was accelerated by urban and industrial development since the late 19th century, and combined with war and economic crisis, this created a new category, a mass, in her words, unable to be integrated into democratic politics. And that mass, she says, has become unbound from traditional class identifications and has consisted of a large population of completely superfluous or expendable people. So that phenomena, Arendt argues, is what gives the totalitarian movements its capacity, its insurgency. There are other sections of society who are also drawn to totalitarianism, according to Arendt. And all of them, and this is a point she emphasises a number of times, are independent of the bourgeoisie. So she divides the kind of base of totalitarianism into three. She essentially says there is a mob who leads the masses, and then there are sections of the elite, and then there are the masses themselves. So there's the mob, there's the masses, and then there's the elite. The mob are more self-conscious elements drawn from the masses. So she says, like Hitler, he's kind of archetypal of the masses, but he's not reducible to them. And when she's talking about the elite, she's referring to artists, writers, and so on, who were so frustrated and embittered by the pre-war situation that they desired to see the ruins of this world. And she makes some kind of interesting points about the attraction of totalitarianism to this layer, but in it she kind of conflates a whole series of figures. So she kind of, she essentially says someone like Brecht, or, you know, some of the kind of the writers in Europe who were kind of attracted to the workers' movement and to Bolshevism, kind of essentially fall into a very similar category as someone like Heidegger. And so, again, this kind of relates to her thing about the content of the politics of what these various figures are kind of arguing is completely irrelevant, and the main dynamic is what was the fractures in society that were kind of making these appeals of interest. Or, you know, so she spends quite a bit of time talking about kind of Ezra Pound and, you know, other kind of fascist poets. Maybe that's controversial. Anyway. Yeah, so she says here, the members of the elite did not object at all to paying a price, the destruction of civilization, for the fun of seeing how those who had been excluded unjustly in the past forced their way into it. The temporary alliance between the elite and the mob rested largely on this genuine delight which the former watched the latter destroy respectability. This could be achieved when the German steel barons were forced to deal with and to receive socially Hitler, the house painter, and self-admitted former derelict. So she kind of says that there's a joy in kind of overturning all of these kind of, you know, social niceties that had previously existed amongst the kind of upper echelons of the societies, of these collapsing societies, and that for a section of kind of intellectuals and artists and so on, kind of, you know, sneering at that, turning it all on its head, you know, held a certain attraction. And, you know, that I think that argument is reasonable to a degree. But I kind of want to move on now to my critique, and then we can conclude and see what people think. While much of her analysis of a particular layer in society, that which she calls the mass, rings quite true, for a certain section of the population in the 20th century, I don't really think it's that helpful for helping us understand how two of the most barbarous regimes in history, Stalin's Russia or Hitler's Germany, actually how they came into being, nor how they continued to operate once they did come into being. Firstly, while there have been significant changes to the nature of modern society, I would fundamentally argue with her categorisation of society as classless. So she kind of tends in this direction without ever kind of spelling it out completely. In fact, I would argue that classes still exist and still bear a role in shaping political life. Similarly, while there is certain alienation and dislocation that comes from mass society, it isn't enough to say that this happens uniformly or automatically across the whole of this sector. So, for instance, the unemployed, the lower ranks of the working class, the partially employed, demobilised soldiers and the like, they weren't all drawn to fascism at the same pace or in the same way. Just yesterday in the session that Nick Everett gave about fascism and the fascist movements in Australia in the 1930s, the Communist Party had just as much success in organising unemployed workers here in Australia as did the far right. You know, so there are a whole, but it's not an automatic kind of process that this upheaval, dislocation occurs in society, and then these particular layers are just kind of drawn into a totalitarian kind of mindset. So politics and political traditions matter. Again, for instance, in Weimar Germany, it mattered that there were a whole variety of kind of leftist organisations that were making arguments to different sections of classes and populations at different times and attempting to kind of organise them. So I would kind of say that these traditions and the extent to which those political parties existed and mobilised people really matters. Secondly, to simply conflate Bolshevism and Nazism as a movement is exceedingly misorienting. The movements, and here I want to make a distinction between the movements of Bolshevism and the movements of Nazism, not the regimes themselves, because we can kind of get to that in a bit, but the movements have profoundly different dynamics. Bolshevism was overwhelmingly a movement of workers, whereas the Nazi Party consisted overwhelmingly of middle-class people, demobilised soldiers, and to the extent that they did organise workers, which they did, these were often previously unorganised workers, white-collar workers, lower-ranking workers, and so on. Ideology does matter for understanding movements. It matters that the Bolsheviks mobilised on the basis of revolutionary working-class challenges to capitalism, whereas the Nazi Party organised around a programme of nationalism, racism, and an economic policy which did not fundamentally challenge the rule of big capital. It mattered that the Bolsheviks emphasised working-class democracy and organised in a fundamentally democratic fashion. So prior to Stalinisation, the Bolshevik Party was a cauldron of debate, argument and decision-making, and the Nazi Party was the polar opposite. It matters in terms of the dynamics of these movements to understand the basis on which, the political basis on which they were being organised, who they were organising, and then the manner in which they were organising, whereas Arendt spends very little time dealing with any of those questions, really. It should also be noted that Stalin did not come to power, just in terms of the differences between the two regimes, on the back of a mass movement. There was never a mass movement that backed up Stalin. There was a regime which was put into place, which helped enact Stalin's rule and power and, helped him consolidate his power, or the bureaucracy's power, but that's very different from a mass movement, and the mass movement did help bring Hitler to power. While both Stalin and Hitler came to power at the head of a bloody counter-revolution, it mattered the manner in which this counter-revolution took place. Who led it? Who acceded to it? Which classes were compromised by it? As Robert Paxton, who gives quite an interesting kind of overview of the history of fascism, disagree with some of it in some ways, but he kind of put it really nicely. He said, Stalin ruled over a society that had been radically simplified by the Bolshevik Revolution, and thus he did not have to concern himself with autonomous concentrations of inherited social and economic power. Hitler, totally unlike Stalin, came into power with the assent and even the assistance of traditional elites and governed in strained but effective association with them. In Nazi Germany, the party jostled with the state bureaucracy, industrial and agricultural proprietors, churches and other traditional elites for power. Totalitarian theory is blind to this fundamental character of the Nazi governing system, and thus tends to fortify the elite's post-war claim that Hitler tried to destroy them, as in the final cataclysm of the Lost War began to do so. So it mattered in terms of a concrete and specific analysis of what shape of capitalist society we're looking at. And it matters for the left in particular to have a concrete, detailed, specific understanding of Stalinist Russia about the nature of the counter-revolution and the shape of society that emerged after the bureaucracy there coalesced. So I find Arendt's analysis far too general and far too ahistorical. So for the revolutionary left, in dealing with the 20th century, where one of the main arguments was between those who wanted to maintain that Marxism is about human liberation and those who wanted to celebrate tyrannical Stalinist regimes, i.e. the Communist parties, it was vital to understand the political dynamics of the Stalinist regimes, what was at play and what wasn't. So there's a couple more issues just before I finish. I think it's also really important that we have an analysis of fascism more specifically. Whereas Stalinism was a particularly 20th century phenomenon, fascism emerges from capitalism in a series of ways. And Arendt's designation of totalitarianism, I would argue, doesn't really capture the fundamental dynamics of what is at play. And in her talk of mass, she misses the specific class dimensions of the classical fascist period. So in Germany, she skims over the often complex interaction between the middle classes, sections of the capitalist class, some intellectuals and the working class. And I kind of don't have time to go into all of those dynamics here, but suffice it to say that they're... Well, I'll come to that a little bit later. In terms of descriptions of the psychology of the middle classes, I think some of Arendt's work is kind of useful, but is best complemented by other people's work. I think Erich Fromm or Reich or some of Trotsky's work is also useful here. But the dynamics of German fascism go beyond merely the psychological composition of the sections of the middle class that made up the bulk of the Nazi Party and of the sections that they actually mobilised themselves. As people would know here, German society of the 30s was highly polarised, and the working class had been one of the most organised and radical in the world. And that situation was deeply unpalatable to the ruling classes, and so they were looking to find mechanisms of undermining the strength of that working class. The rulers of the system, so the big capitalists and the political elites, were terrified that a workers' revolution would do them out of their money, their power and their privilege. And so this kind of dynamic was happening at the same time as there was this layer of the middle classes who were becoming increasingly frustrated and were thrown into disarray and so on. So the relationship between the bourgeoisie of Germany at the time and the Nazi Party and sectors of the middle class, they kind of shifted and changed over time. But ultimately, I think it would be very difficult to say that the Nazi Party came to power merely on the back of the kind of power and strength and aggravation of the frustration of the middle classes themselves. I think to say that it's hard to imagine Hitler coming to power without the backing of certain sections of capital and certain sections of the old German state is not at all to say, as many of the communist parties did. And again, I think Arendt is kind of in argument with many of the kind of communist parties of the time who were essentially kind of presenting fascism as merely a movement of one section of kind of capital, and really discounted the whole kind of, relatively sort of autonomous middle-class movements of the period. So in ascribing the totalitarian movements overwhelmingly as defined by their mass character and their political psychology to simply a periodization of modernity, I would say she misses the more dialectical dynamics of politics, economics and class. And all of that matters for an analysis of fascist movements today. Arendt's understanding of the totalitarian inclined mass doesn't really point in the direction of either comprehending the class dynamics that might push certain layers of society towards fascism, nor does it help us develop decent strategies for challenging the far right. Her assessment of the mouse might offer some insight into the kind of very general dynamic that modern alienated capitalism breeds, but it doesn't say much about why these layers might be drawn in some instances and repelled in others by totalitarian or fascist ideologies. So, for instance, why have fascist movements grown dramatically in Austria and not in Spain or in Greece over the last few years? Why Hungary? And again, I would kind of argue that, that it's necessary to have some concrete political assessment of the histories and dynamics of those places rather than this kind of much more general kind of analysis of modernity as kind of being the underlying feature. Okay, and then there is just the realities of the regimes themselves. So if that's talking about the movements, we're talking about the totalitarian regimes, just to conclude. The totalitarian argument assumes the complete success of the regimes to be as complete as their leaders' aspirations. So as Paxton says, the totalitarian image may evoke powerfully the dreams and aspirations of dictators, but it actually obstructs any examination of the vital matter of how effectively fascist regimes manage to embed themselves in the half-compliant, half-recalcitrant societies they ruled. So, for instance, despite the attempts of Hitler to create a society of total domination, the reality of the state was actually quite disorderly and acted in oftentimes uncoordinated and irrational fashion. The other limitation of Arendt's analysis is that it doesn't account for resistance or agency of the population under the totalitarian regimes themselves. So do the layers who had previously been committed to bringing the totalitarian regimes to power remain so? What of the plebeian layers of the Nazi Party who were turned upon in the Night of the Long Knives? What of the political agency of workers under these regimes? The regimes attempt total domination, but do they achieve it? Are there chinks? What, and if there are, what, where do they come from? What are the breaks? And here the work of people like Timothy Mason, who's a historian of the Third Reich, and he talks a lot about the kind of working class resistance that existed, you know, right through, you know, both in the period, you know, immediately after Hitler's ascension to power, and then right through to the end of the war. And I would say Arendt, again, elides historical details for generalities. Indeed, she doesn't really ask or answer the question, how might movements of resistance be encouraged and built? Who to look towards? So, for instance, the Origins barely touches on those issues. And to the extent that Arendt takes up any similar themes, it only occurs before the regimes come to power. And it's much less so in the actual work itself, and she talks much more, you know, in a whole variety of her kind of other more political works, where she says that the only real talisman against the development of totalitarianism is civil society, democratic debate, and kind of discussion. So, you know, not much of a talisman, in my opinion. So, just to conclude, I would say that while Arendt's work in The Origins offers some valuable and insightful descriptions of some of the dynamics, quirks, and qualities of what you would call the mass base of totalitarianism, and I might call the mass base of fascism, her work comes up seriously short in offering us a route to understand the situation today or even the historical conjuncture that she's writing in. The crisis of neoliberal capitalism, the collapse of the centre and social democratic parties, the wars in the Middle East, and the concomitant crisis of imperialism and the decline and collapse of working class organisation and institutions have, across the world, shaped a political space where far-right ideas can get a hold amongst sections of the middle classes, impoverished workers, and some sections of blue-collar and other unorganised workers. The ruling class has also increasingly allowed and supported the growth of far-right electoral parties, and sections of the state have endorsed and encouraged the growth of fascist gangs. I would argue that a framework that foregrounds class, that understands the rise and fall of political dynamics of the 20th century and puts an emphasis on resistance is far preferable. And I would say that analysis should be the kind of content that revolutionary Marxists want to bring us to and would give us a very solid architecture for understanding the situation today.